So anyway, for this evening's talk, it's basically just how to deal with some of the difficulties we're experiencing in life. I don't know why I keep having to talk about this, because even though monks and nuns have difficulties, but then we deal with it very easily in life. One of the reasons why it's pretty easy to deal with in life as a monk, because we're actually taught how to do that for such a long time. Very good. You're both wearing the same jackets, so. Plan to, okay. But then no, the three of us are wearing the same costume as well, so that's fair enough. But anyway, some of the problems we experience in life is, first of all, to be able to laugh at those problems instead of just to feel that somehow you made a big mistake and feel embarrassed by them. It's one of the reasons why I enjoyed the teachings of the Buddha. They weren't just for meditation. Meditation gave the source of the wisdom. But you could test the wisdom out because you could use it so wonderfully well for solving problems in life. And a good example of that was many years ago when I was in Singapore. I say that because I'm going to Singapore next weekend at last. Tomorrow, but 8 days' time. At last, we could actually go traveling again, which is wonderful to share these teachings around. But anyway, this gentleman, he was a bit of a rush. He asked me, Ajahn Brahm, what is suffering? What is Buddhism? What do you teach? And put it in a nutshell for me. And I said to him that suffering is asking from this world something it can never give you. And of course, it just came out of the blue. It's a way of talking about the nature of life. And it's also very appropriate at all times of your life. What do you ask for? What do you expect? And when you expect what this world cannot give you, that is suffering for you, disappointment. It's good to be able to try better to make it sort of so you can get more peace, more happiness, more harmony, more friendship in this world. But it seems to be that the human beings in this realm always need somehow to make mistakes, sometimes big mistakes, stupid mistakes. Why do they always do this? Why do we still need wars? Why do we still need to argue with one another? Either just governments. Why do governments sometimes, please excuse me, seem so stupid? Sometimes they say, Ajahn Brahm, you should take over. Of course you'd never do that, because that is asking from the monks what we can never do, what we should never do. So that those people who want to sort of control but within limits. It's one of the reasons why that sometimes democracies sometimes work, simply because they're very slow and sometimes a little bit ineffective. But that slowness, ineffectiveness, that is actually allowing human beings to be better at running things. Allow people to be more involved with caring for one another, looking after one another, and actually making a better world. And little by little, it's the human beings which count. Sometimes not all the rules and regulations which the government give us. I'm being a bit sort of radical here. But nevertheless, I don't know, maybe I'm getting too old. But little things. I was telling some people on a retreat about a monk who inspired me a lot when I was in Thailand. And that particular monk was sent to jail for 2 years. And it was a trumped-up charge. Somebody just wanted to get rid of him because he was a really, really good monk. And when he went to jail, he wrote a book about it afterwards and saying, these were the best years of his life. Being in jail, he never needed to give any talks. He never needed to answer people's questions. He didn't have to go out to other people's houses for dinner. He didn't have to join committees. He didn't have to... Oh, he could just sit in this little cell all day long, get nice food. He could read whatever he wanted. He could meditate as long as he wanted. He said, so much freedom in prison. And when I read that, it inspired me because it was so not what I expected. And so sometimes when you hear stories like that, and they're true stories, you sometimes see that the person sees things in a totally different way than ordinary people. It was 2 days of holidays for him. So little by little, when we start to see things in a different way, it gives us just more ways of dealing with the difficulties and problems in life. We expect those problems and difficulties to happen. We can't always live forever. I don't know that sometimes people keep asking me, Ajahn Brahm, how old are you? Can you please live for another, what they asked me the other day, another 40 years? Oh, come on, that's torture. I'm 70, it's my 71st birthday soon. They want to live me to 111. So that's actually quite a nice number, isn't it, 111? Okay. That's what he was just asking, because sometimes whenever a monk says any number, many people, especially if they come from Asia, from Thailand or from Cambodia, they were sort of by lottery numbers. They think the monk has just got powers. You can see. If I could see the lottery numbers coming up next week or whenever it's coming up, I would deliberately give you the wrong ones. Simply because even people don't realize that wealth is a burden and it's suffering. How much money do you need? How much do you want? After a while, we realize it's not money we want. What we really want is peace and good health. If you spend all the time worrying about money, it's not going to be healthy and happy at all. You have enough. Come on. Be honest. We could always do some more, but then some more, and then some more, and then some more. Please come and see just how your monks and nuns live. Go down to their monasteries and see in their rooms. But right now, just where I live in Bodhinyana Monastery, I live in a cave. The door is unlocked. I don't lock the door before I go out. It's unlocked. I lock the door when I'm in there so people don't disturb me. But when I go up in Nolat Mara Center, the door is unlocked. You can go inside and have a squiz, as they say. And you find there's hardly anything there. You don't need much to be happy. What you really need is wisdom and kindness. That more than anything else. That is the wealth of a monk or a nun. That's the wealth of you. Your friends, your kindness, your understanding of life. It's amazing just how many people have such a long life. They still don't understand what the meaning of life is. It doesn't matter what gender you are, doesn't matter what age you are, what religion you are, where you come from in the world. It's amazing just how many wonderful friends you can make over all these years which I've lived here in Perth. And those friends are just, especially the friends I'm not supposed to be friends with. I don't know why that's the case. Because over these years I just recall just making friends with my favorite rabbi, this old Moshe Bernstein, with the dean of St. George's Cathedral, an Anglican. There was it John Shepherd? With who else did I make friends with? Oh, just the abbot of the Benedictine monastery up in New Norcia, the former one, Abbot Placid. He was really a good friend and a good fun to be with. You know, once he was taking me around that old monastery in New Norcia. It's very old, one of the oldest buildings in Western Australia. So I couldn't resist asking him, are there any ghosts in that temple up in New Norcia? He looked at me and said, I'm a Catholic, we don't believe in ghosts. And I looked at him back and said, what about the Holy Ghost then? You got me. We're just laughing at each other, or with each other. And those encounters with people from different ways of looking, okay, I made the best use of that. Because I remember on one other occasion that I was doing a seminar. We do all these seminars or conferences all over the place. And at this particular conference, it was in UWA many years ago. And somebody at this conference asked me a very powerful question. And I knew actually who the questioner was. It was actually Father Frank Brennan. And he was a very intellectual heavyweight in Australia. He was one of the people which I think one of the governments asked to add a human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. So I remember at the time when he asked me this question, I could not tell a joke. Because if I told a joke, it would just... he was an intellectual, he was a professor even. It would go over his head. Please excuse me. But that old story years ago, I suppose it's okay now as well. This person who had graduated with a PhD from one of the great universities, the only job he could get was in the supermarket, sweeping the floors. And the young graduate just complained. So look, I've got a graduate degree and you give me the job sweeping the floors. And the boss of the supermarket said, oh, sorry, I didn't realize that you are a university graduate. Now, here is the broom. This is actually how you sweep. Please excuse me again. But anyway, this question was a fascinating question because he asked me directly and it was being recorded and stuff. He said, Ajahn Brahm, you're a Buddhist. What do Buddhists believe about God? Now, normally, I say, oh, Buddhists don't believe in God. No creator God. No, just we don't have a God. We have a law of karma and stuff, but not a God. That's how you'd normally answer. But I wanted to take this much further, more deeper. And also in a way which could create some peace and harmony, between different peoples. So I said, well, the gentleman next to me, Abbot Placid, we've had lots of conversations. We respect one another. I don't agree with him, but we respect one another. And I said, so often he's told me that one of his core beliefs, this is him saying and not me, his core beliefs was everyone is searching for God. Now remember, I'm a Buddhist monk up here, leader of the Buddhist tradition, so I'm not trying to convert you. I'm not like, what they call it, sleepers. I've been put in the Buddhist Society of WA to convert everybody at the last minute. No, he said, he's a friend. What does he mean by that? And then I started contemplating, as a Buddhist monk, as my friends, other Buddhist monks, as you, what have you been searching for? And then I started coming up with all his wonderful qualities. Each one of you, atheists, Hindus, Sikhs, Catholics, Muslims, what most people really are searching for, first of all, is respect. Each one of you need and require being respected, no matter where you come from, no matter just what you look like. It's one of the reasons why that we try very, very hard to find solutions when people are stigmatized, because of what they look like or how they behave, or what gender they are, what age they are. Want everyone to be welcome and feel, especially in this place, the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, to be welcome, no matter who you are. That's why we don't look at people when you come in and say, now, get out. Oh, this is just a little story, by the by. I've been teaching a couple of retreats, back to back over in Jhana Grove. And I remember just when, this is not this retreat, but a few years ago, when a gentleman came on my retreat, and when he actually checked in, I happened to be by the reception, to receive these guests who were on a 9-day retreat. I'd never seen him before. When I looked at him, he was Caucasian, a big Australian guy, and he was wearing traditional Australian dress. Thongs, shorts, and a dirty t-shirt. Honestly. And he had tattoos all over him and big curly hair. Now, quite frankly, people who look like that are very rare in our monasteries. And so straight out, I took one look at him and said to him, sir, I stereotyped him. I shouldn't have done this, it was a mistake, but I love telling people about my mistakes, they make life more interesting. I said, sir, I think you're in the wrong place. Just 8 kilometers down the road is Carnet Prison Farm. If you're trying to visit some of your friends, they're not. And then he said, I'm on the retreat. Really? I checked his name, he was on there. Oh, fair enough. I don't select who goes on the retreat by how they look. I don't know how they look. Anyway, you're on the retreat, fine. I stigmatized him just by how he looked. And I got my reward afterwards. Because when he came to one of the interviews, he just blew my mind that he got some amazing meditation. I don't readily tell people that they've got jhanas. I told him. Those are incredible states of mind. Wow. He just described it. That's a jhana. Well done. Like, if my legs were long enough, I'd have kicked myself after a stupid Ajahn Brahm. But that taught me lessons. You cannot so judge a person. And if you do judge a person, that's called stereotyping. It's unfair, untrue, unreal. Please never, ever do that. So little by little, we try and make this open for everybody. That's why I just like conversations with different people and share those conversations. So when I answered, he said, well, if everybody is believing in God, or not so believing, everyone's searching, what are you searching for? What do you search for? Respect is one of these. It's kindness, to love others and to be loved yourself. Have you never been loved? Never had the opportunity to love someone else, to find peace and truth and meaning? So that's what people are searching for. I think everybody can agree to that. So I said, if everybody is searching for that, that must be what that God means. So that's the Buddhist idea of God. I'll put my hand up. Respect, love, kindness, peace, meaning, understanding. Not anything which separates us, but things which can actually join us, which is not against any Buddhist teachings or any other teachings. something which can give meaning to us. I was very happy that Frank Brennan said, oh, yes, good answer, yeah, well done. Phew. But anyway, little by little, that's actually how we overcome some of the sufferings in life. We don't expect to express these things in exactly the same way. But instead, we have this other opportunity, which is actually combine our understandings. Do you really want to know what the real, true, deep Buddhist teachings are? They're not in books. The books show you, point the way. But the real teachings are found just in the human beings, in the mind. That's where they find. And that's where you get these incredible teachings and understandings. That's where you understand what the Buddha said. And one of those little teachings, please excuse me for mentioning it again, that's all that, don't argue. Why do people argue so much? Instead of arguing, we should be listening to one another. Then what happens? And we respect one another. We say, this monk says this monk says that. I say this, and none of those things are the same. What's going on? Is one person right and the other two wrong? The answer is no. Seeing different aspects of things, and we combine those three aspects together, four aspects, five aspects, combine them all together, and then we get a much more accurate understanding of the truth. We don't just take one person's view and think that's right. I know that in Bodhinyana Monastery, and I was founded that, I don't know, 39 years ago now, with Ajahn Jaco, yeah, two of us, such a long time ago. And so after a while, we just made the monastery rules. And the monastery rules, we had it in there for a while. The first rule of monastery rule is the abbot, me, is always right. But if he's wrong, go back to rule number one. Okay, that was only a joke, okay. But we changed it. The most important rule in the monastery, which we can all agree on, is kindness and compassion. That's the most important rule for the monastic community. And that actually is there. It's the same with our Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Unfortunately, that's why I keep, being your spiritual, what's the title? Spiritual dictator. It's not spiritual dictator, that's again a bit of a joke. It's director. But what we do is that kindness is the most important. Now think of that. Just being kind to one another. Just being kind to others. That is actually what creates some power. That's why, we haven't got the bhikkhunis here this evening. A couple of them are coming tomorrow for the AGM. And I think Ayahasapanya is leading the teaching next week. Yeah. So little by little, is it Ayahasapanya? Yeah, I think she's next week. So little by little, we're kind enough, to all genders, LGBTQIA+. Don't care what you're, and plus, yeah. Don't care, don't discriminate according to your gender specifications. Or how you view your gender, or your age. But we do make distinctions between how people behave. So your kindness is the most important. And little by little, as I said, just that gentleman who just totally surprised me by getting into a deep meditation, a real one. Even these days, I cannot really tell when someone comes on a retreat. Or when they get ordained as a monk or a nun, cannot really tell who's going to really make it in that monastic system. You give them opportunities and chances. They take those chances. Some don't. But you give, oh, they don't straight away. Later on they do. You give them that opportunity. And that's one of the wonderful things which I get a lot of job satisfaction from. Every now and again, someone sends me little emails. That monk you sent down to Margaret River, the monk or the nun who's over in Sydney, he's done a wonderful job. And they mean that. And that gives you so much satisfaction that what this Buddhism community can do is really huge. And sometimes I get, not embarrassed, but I get dumbfounded by just how the power of goodness and kindness can create harmony in our world. And again, it's not just just with an Anglican bishop, but the old Moshe Bernstein. He was one of these, he's a good friend. And I remember he also said that he certainly believes in rebirth. And when I mentioned that to one of the other top rabbis in Perth, he said, oh yeah, he's a very unique idea of Judaism. Which means that he wasn't really totally accepted. A bit of a rebel, so that's why I thought he's a wonderful person. I don't know. I don't know about you, but do you like rebels? I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, that this gentleman, Rabbi Bernstein, he was for 1 year, he was the rabbi at Carmel School, the Jewish school here in Perth. And he said the kids at Jewish school were having a lot of difficulties, you know, with their year 12s exams. They were getting very anxious. He says, can you come for the day and teach them just how to relax? Basically meditation, so I did that. This is helping out an old friend. And after teaching that for one whole day about how to relax, you know, a whole big, huge number of Jewish kids, then I didn't know what happened, but then I got a letter from the principal. Ajahn, thank you for coming to my school. That year, Carmel School got the number one in the whole of West Australia, top school. They never invited me back again. I'm not sure why, but they got the top school. But it works. Some of them, how to overcome stress and fear of the future. And this is little meditation. It's incredibly powerful. How you let little things, that all the concern we have about the past, and we've read this, heard this so many times, but how do you let go of the past? How do you let go of the future and all the worries about it? After a while, it's so simple to understand how you let go of your past. No matter how bad it was or how good it was, there's always some of each. You cannot expect the whole past to be perfect. You cannot expect your behavior to have been perfect. Be honest, number one. And number two, be kind. Be kind to the past, your past. And all the people who are actors on that great play which has come to this point right now. If you're kind to all those people and kind to yourself, it softens the past. All those things which are very hard for you to take and understand and accept, after a while it just makes the past less sharp, less sticky. And you're kind to it, and after a while you can let it go. I remember reading this article about a lady, and one of these articles which really moved me, that she was in Auschwitz. And when she was in Auschwitz, She was there because she was the younger sister of a twin. And when they discovered they were identical twins, so not younger sister, but an identical twin, they were forced to go on this program of experimentation. I think the name of the doctor at the time, Dr. Mengele, I think it was. But this was one of Dr. Mengele's assistants. She remembered as her sister, the other twin, was basically just treated so badly and tortured and killed as an experiment. This other sister survived. And after many, many, many years, she discovered the location of one of the doctors who had helped Dr. Mengele. And according to this story which she wrote, she invited the person who had basically tortured and killed and her sister to meet her in Auschwitz. This is a true story. When they met them there, sort of she forgave him. She said, look, I found you, and I've been hating you and hating what happened to my sister all my life. Now you're here. I don't want to be a victim anymore. She said, I want to be a victor. So she forgave. And when someone could forgive something that was so powerful, that was incredibly sort of strong emotions it evoked in me, because I've never been in Auschwitz. But anyway, it did something which was showed us how you can be kind to the past. And you can use the past to be able to let go. There's another story about Auschwitz, which I remember reading. A good story. There was a backpacker who was traveling through Europe. Say, travel is now becoming allowable again. When this backpacker was traveling through Europe, he just got a job at restaurants and cafes and just any old easy work, just get a few more dollars, and then he would go on his next leg of his journey. And he got a job in this restaurant in somewhere in Germany. And then as he was, I think in Austria, I think he said, in that restaurant, it was always known if you get a job in a restaurant, you get free food. That's no part of the deal. You don't get paid very much. You get a few tips. But the free food makes it just really quite worthwhile. But then one day, the owner of the restaurant told all the workers he'd ordered too much sauerkraut. I don't know if you know sauerkraut. We have a couple of German monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. And even though he's not a monk, we have, like, you know what I'm talking about, Amandus. Many of you have been down there, you know Amandus. And he loves sauerkraut. So anyway, they'd ordered too much sauerkraut, and so the owner of the restaurant, this is quite a few years ago, told everybody, if you want free food, it has to be sauerkraut. Sauerkraut for breakfast, sauerkraut for lunch, sauerkraut for dinner, whatever it is, sauerkraut and only sauerkraut. And this young backpacker said, you can't do that to us. That is unfair. That's not what we signed up for. I know some people like sauerkraut, but not everyone likes sauerkraut. This is not right. You can't do this to us. And he got very angry. And that apparently was when the cook of the restaurant came up and took him aside and said, look, I've been working at this restaurant for quite a few years now, said this old man. And he said, I want to tell you the difference between a problem and an irritation. And then this old cook, he bared his arm and you could see the tattooed numbers on his arm. He said, I was in Auschwitz. And he said, every morning when I woke up, I didn't know whether I would survive that day. I was very fortunate. Many of my relations and friends and loved ones did die. I survived. Living in Auschwitz, that is a problem. Eating sauerkraut is only an irritation. I remember reading that, I thought, wow, that is so true. All the stuff you get angry about, stuff you argue with your loved ones, your partner, all the things which you feel angry about yourself, is that really a problem? Or is it an irritation? And often you've found that most of the stuff which upsets us in life are irritations, not really big problems. That's why when you understand what life can give you and what life can't give you, and live within those means, then you can finally have a very peaceful life. Even though you don't have much, you may be sick, you may have people around you passing away. That's life. So little by little, when we understand what life can give us and what it can't give us, you look at this life in a much broader picture. And that broader picture is realizing that all the disappointments you have in life, you should have expected those. They're not your fault or somebody else's fault. And sometimes it's from those experiences, those are the ones we really learn from. They can be painful at the time, but afterwards, it's almost like you say, thank you. Simple one. Just, I don't know why, but recently it seems that many people which I know come to monasteries and stuff seem to have died. Even young ones pass away. When young persons pass away, I don't so concerned about how or why they passed away. But sometimes people say 27 is too young to die. Or sometimes even younger than that, people pass away. It's okay if you're 70 or 71. Is that old enough to pass away? Yeah. But kids passing away. So what happens? Why? And that is why the Buddhist story, and I tell stories, because through those stories you can remember and you understand much more about the truth of our world, what it can give, what it can't give. And that was a story this old monk told me. This old monk he told some wonderful stories. He was living by himself in a bamboo and thatch hut in the middle of the jungle many years ago. He said even one evening, just late at night, there was a knock on his door. And he was, who's knocking on the door? No one comes here at night time. And he said that when he opened the door, there was a monkey who was holding a little dead baby, a dead baby monkey in her arms. And he realized this was one of the monkeys in the forest around him who had lost her kid. And what does a monkey know what to do? He gave it to the monk, or she gave it to the monk, almost asking the monk, can you do something to bring my baby back to life? And the monk just, looked at the baby monkey. It was dead, no possibility of reviving it, but at least did some chanting. And after doing a little chanting for the baby monkey, gave the little baby back to its mum. And the monkey, just obviously had very wet eyes, just went away. It was just like how sort of people live in the forest a long time. Actually, the animals get to know you. And somehow or other, this grief-stricken mother monkey thought that maybe the monk could do something. But it couldn't. But anyway, the same monk said that when there was a storm in the forest and many trees came down, he was scared because one big branch would fall on his hut and it would crush him to bits, would kill him. The worst fear is if one of those big branches would injure him because then the pain would last longer. This was the middle of nowhere. He wouldn't be able to find his way out of the forest. But anyway, He was fine. But in the morning, he checked all of the leaves on the forest floor. It was a fallen leaf story. When you look at all the leaves which had been torn off the tree of life, you know, by the winds, they were mostly the old leaves, old brown leaves, many yellow leaves as well, a few green leaves, and one or two bright green leaves. You know, the sort of colour which tell you that that leaf had only sprouted forth the night before or the day before. They too had been torn off and lay dead on the ground. And he looked to see what leaves were left on the branches. And most of the leaves on the branches, of course, were the green leaves. But even though young green leaves had been torn off and lay dead, there were still many old brown leaves, 71 years old and older, still clinging on. Why? It's unfair. But he realized that's life. Next time you have someone very close to you who dies when they're young, I mean really young, never think that, why? Welcome to our world of life. Mostly the old ones go first, but some young ones are still alive. So some young ones die while the old ones keep living. Why? This is our world. So please understand our world. Don't expect from this world something it will never be able to give you. And then you're more at peace and at ease with our world. We seek respect, we seek kindness, and of course, it makes life much easier if you never ever accept that this is the only life you will ever live. Does that make sense to you? There's only one life. If it does, there's only one life. It sometimes is very unfair. But when it's one life and another life, another life and another life and another life, as many as you need to learn, to grow, to understand, to serve, it makes life much more understandable and acceptable. It also happens to be true. That's one of the things through our meditations. You can understand your past lives and previous life, how it all works. That's one of the reasons why, yeah, I could say that and give examples and stuff, but that never convinces people. What one really needs is one's own experience. And there's lots of stuff about that. You can read, find out, even just in your meditation, to ask yourself, what's your earliest memory? Who were you in the past? And once you find that out, it gives a bigger picture to this thing we call life and how it all works. If you haven't experienced that yet, just put it on the back burner and wait till you get a nice meditation or something happens. And sometimes you see why you are who you are and what this life is all about. Thank you for listening. Oh my goodness, that's got, well, I haven't been here for 2 or 3 weeks. So, instead of going sadhu, 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 how does it go? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. All it means is awesome, 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 awesome. That's very nice. Okay. Now, before I do some questions from, usually from overseas, any questions from the people here? Give you a chance, yeah. Not a comment, Eddie, just a question. Okay, dear old Eddie.
Go on.
Thank you. Okay, we'll leave it there while I'm ahead. So the first question from Aviv Levy. Dear Ajahn, when I meditate without a guide or a timer, I do not know when is the right time to end a meditation. How can I tell when a meditation ended naturally and I should get up? Thank you. No, sometimes you can ask your mind. Just ask the question, do you want to get up? Sometimes if you ask that question, you listen afterwards, you get an answer. It's simple mindfulness. I ask my legs, legs, how are you when you start meditation? How's your mind? Do you want to carry on for a little bit longer? A lot of times mine says, no, enough. Someone says, yeah, please. It's like you get an awareness of your mind. And then experiment with that, see how it works. Next one is from Borneo. Dear Ajahn, can we control our thoughts? What should we do to manage negative thoughts and feelings arise? What is the connection between mind and thoughts? The thoughts are like the waves on the surface of a lake. It's a nice way of imagining it, visualizing it. What causes those waves on the lake? It's either the wind. It could be something disturbing it, like a boat or something, or fish in that water. But if there's nothing in the water and it's a still night, then that water becomes really smooth and peaceful. You have no thoughts. Perfectly aware. And that wonderful simile of meditation, that when your lake is perfectly smooth without any ripples on the surface, then you can see a perfect reflection of the full moon in the night sky or the stars in the sky. But if there's a slight ripple in that water's surface, it distorts the image. That's one of the reasons why when the mind is really still and no thoughts, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. It's inspiring. And each one of you can do that. The point is that when the mind is still, enjoy it. It's the enjoyment, it's teaching your own mind what is more beautiful. And you'll always go for the more attractive. So that's how you don't control your thoughts. You stop wanting anything, where the thoughts come from. Wanting is the wind, which disturbs, as Ajahn Chah would put it, the leaves on a tree. They only move because of the wind. If the wind stopped, the leaves would still move, but less and less and less, until they become perfectly still, because that's their nature. The default state of the mind is not to think. We've got into the habit of thinking. And I please excuse me, but this was one of the old stories which I hadn't told for a while. I was surprised how I hadn't told it for a while. And the Thai retreat. And that was when we had to work very hard as young monks under Ajahn Chah. I'm talking about working from about 8:30 in the morning to something like 7-8 o'clock at night. Full on, no rest. We had a one meal of the day, which was a very, very small amount to eat. Moving some earth in wheelbarrows in the hot, steamy, mosquito-infested jungles of Thailand. Moving it all day, and it didn't finish in one day. Another day, 3 days of moving all this earth. And I didn't have time for a shower. Didn't have time to wash my robes, no time to meditate. Just as soon as the day was finished, you slept. Got up in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, we had to go to the morning meeting, and then arms out, eat, and then work again for I don't know how many more hours. Very tough. But 3 days, we were finished. So I thought, because that night Ajahn Chah went to another monastery. And that said, the second monk, Ajahn Liam, said, I think you put it in the wrong place. Let's move it to somewhere else. He had a point. So, okay. Another 3 days of hard work, sweating, smelly, unwashed, bitten by mosquitoes, really hard work, tired, exhausted. But at the end of those 3 days, we'd finished. 6 days of hard work. Oh, that was tough. When I went to bed that night, I thought, I'm going to have a nice wash tomorrow morning and do some meditation. Oh, I can't wait till tomorrow. But what happened? That night, Ajahn Chah came back. And he said, I thought I told you to put it over there. You put it over here. Move it. And that's when I lost my faith. Honestly, I did. I thought, I never became a monk to work like a laborer. That's not what I signed up for. This is not good enough. And because I was with a load of northeastern Thai monks, they spoke this Isan language. So I told the Thais this, and it's honest, I started bad language in English, thinking they could understand me. But of course, they could not understand what I was saying. Well, they did understand my body language. I was really upset. And that was when this one monk came up to me, and I can never remember who he was, but I really thank him so much. He came up to me, and this is where I first heard, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. That was incredibly profound. It was obviously true, but as soon as I understood that, I stopped thinking about it and stopped complaining in my head. And then actually, it was true. It was easy to push the wheelbarrow. We had a lot of fun, had races with other monks. And one of these monks who was serving there was mean to me. You know, sometimes it happens, you know, you're tired. You know, you're shoveling some soil in one wheelbarrow, and sometimes it misses the wheelbarrow and falls on the other monk. And as we were playing around and having some fun, when you didn't think about it, it was very easy. And I realized that my whole of my life is like that. You have to give a talk. You have to go overseas. You have to build a monastery. You have a bushfire. You have to rebuild it again, whatever. Doing it is very easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Being the president of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, it's actually easy. Thinking about it's a tough part. Whatever you have to do. Sometimes you have to have an operation. People say, oh, this is painful. Doing it is easy. Thinking about it is a difficulty. That is actually how you stop thinking so much. It's just torturing yourself. It's not worth it. Just do it. Simple. Anyway, from Rosa. Hello, can you please explain how to deal with people who have personality disorders, like narcissistic personality disorder or psychopathy? Why don't they have empathy? It is better to distance or help them. Depends who you are. Depends who they are as well. Because sometimes, please excuse me, but I don't like those names of narcissistic personality disorder or psychopathy. I prefer looking at people who have those designations. There's another name you call someone which stigmatizes them and puts them in a box. And they don't belong in that box. They tend to live up to what you expect of them. I know this is a bit controversial, but I just do remember this professor of psychiatry at Singapore. He was a Catholic, I was a Buddhist. But then he invited me to bless his unit in Singapore. So what unit is it? And what are you teaching in this big Singapore psychiatric hub? And he said, I'm teaching schizophrenia, or how to cure schizophrenia. I said, well, how do you do that? He said, I don't. What do you mean you don't cure schizophrenia? He said, I cure the other part of the patient, which isn't schizophrenic. I understood what he meant. You don't focus on their faults. They're more than that. No human being has just got this one or two or three so-called problems. They change from day to day, hour to hour. That's basic Buddhism. This mind arises at one thing, passes away at another thing day by day. You have tendencies, but those tendencies aren't permanent. So he was noticing all these clients who were in that hospital because of schizophrenia, they were diagnosed. They weren't schizophrenic 100% of the time. There were times when they weren't. And that's what he focused on. There are times when people are narcissistic, but they're not always. There's more to them than that. Psychopaths, sometimes people act like psychopaths. You know, sometimes you see some of these people in jail for terrible things they've done. You talk to them, get to know them. They're much more than that. That's how they behave. It's not who they are. But anyway, that's really deep stuff. If you can't do that, then again, distance. To love the tiger, but at a distance. And lastly from UK, Ajahn Brahm, how Buddhism can help a person trapped in Mariupol in Ukraine? Is how Buddhism can, the future is always uncertain. We got a lovely email from a gentleman over in Moscow a few days ago. Where's Lucky? Is he still here? Lucky, no, Lucky's gone. But anyway, this fellow's trapped in, not trapped, but he was in Moscow, and he said this is the most hated country in the world right now. He said, but not all Russians are bad. Many of us hate the war and are ashamed of it. And he said, please, 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 is it okay if on Waysak Day that you can give me the three refuges and the five precepts, the online Waysak, which we always do every year? He said, of course. We don't judge any person just because where they come from. Or know what gender they are, who they are. Of course you can take the three refuges and the five precepts in Moscow. Of course. But anyway, little by little, if someone is in Mariupol, please don't hate the oppressors. If you're in there, just wait and see, things happen. Who knows how we can, people can become free. It's a hard journey for you. But I just remember many of my relations and friends in London during the Second World War, bombed to smithereens. You know the little terrace houses you may see in UK? My mum and my grandma were in one house. She was a young 14 or 15-year-old girl at the time. And the bomb hit the house next door. And they're just real big bombs. So the family next door instantly killed. And my mother just, her arm was slashed, apparently. But they survived. They had to move out. The house was destroyed. But she survived. There's so many memories like that. And maybe some of you may have had families during the wars in the world, which suffered immensely. But they also said that was a time they learned so much and they grew so much. A great deal of friendship and care for one another. Because they had to. So anyway, hopefully those questions were helpful. The answers were helpful. Great questions, and thank you for that. So is there any other questions from here before we finish off? I've got one over here.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, can you come to the mic? Yeah, okay. Oh, no, the mic is coming for you. Thanks for good old Eddie. Yeah, yay. Yeah.
This is probably a little bit off centre, but I'm wanting to know the difference between violence and love in the contents of, say, 1963 in Saigon, when the monks was engulfed in flames, and you know, that was looked on upon as a act of love and in activism. How can that not be a violent... How can that not be violent?
Yes, it was violent.
Yeah.
You can't survive it. The reason you're saying that is because very recently, apparently there was somebody who set themselves alight as a protest about climate change. You know, that the world is really heating up. And just, you know, to make it very clear to people.
Even as a monk to do that?
It's basically what's allowed, not allowed. No one's going to punish him afterwards once he's dead. But nevertheless, it's not an advisable thing to do. There's many other ways to get people's attention. And sometimes that we think we need to do something really strong to get people's attention. But that's actually not how things change. How things change to get many, many people, hundreds, thousands of people to change. That's much more effective than one person just doing an extreme act. Yeah, extremity. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I would say that, you know, it had really good intentions in a way, but it was a bad choice.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I remember in Czechoslovakia there was a gentleman. I still remember his name, Jan Palach, who burnt himself in the main square as a protest to the communist suppression in Czechoslovakia at the time. Czechoslovakia, not Czechoslovakia, the one country. And they named the square after him, John Palach Square. He became a hero because it was, in that particular time, they needed somebody. So who's a hero, who's not a hero? They do the same thing. It's who you decide afterwards. Anyway, so it is 4 minutes past nine, o'clock, so is it time to finish off now? Okay, very good. Okay, so now we can do the bowing three times the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And you're most welcome to come up to see the monks and just ask your personal questions afterwards. But thank you for that question.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami.